And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
When I was a child, I used to wonder how Santa put my toys under the tree. I said, Mama, can you tell me how this can be when there ain't no chimneys in the project?
Ain't no chimneys in the ghetto.
Not in the project.
Ain't no chimneys in the project.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. I'm Phil Lairness. And this...
I'm Dean Haglund.
Is Dean Haglund, all the way back in Australia. How are you, sir?
Oh, my God. What's more exciting than the asthma thunderstorm? It's heading this way after attacking Melbourne. This is a weather phenomena that has sickened 3,000 people. And I don't know how many have... they're attributing to death. But basically, it's all the pollen is electrified and then shoved up into your sinuses in a thunderstorm kind of way. And if you have asthma, they tell you to stay indoors and don't go out in a thunderstorm.
You know, that treatment, that electrified pollen shoved up the nose, women in Beverly Hills are paying top dollar for that treatment.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It happens naturally here, so they're more than welcome to come on down.
Our levels are all over the place at the beginning of this show, so we apologize if we have a little bit of technical difficulty. But really, seriously, as always, how much do you pay for the show?
That's where all the money goes to, that technical wonders.
The opening song was another little choice tidbit from the late, great Miss Sharon Jones, who we celebrated on last week's show. And it's from a Christmas album that she and the Dap Kings dropped at the end of November 2015. And I share it with you not only because we're heading into the holiday season, whether we want to or not, but also because one of the things we're going to discuss on this show, as per a letter from listener Ryan Lescote, is diversity in television. And we'll talk about this later on the show, but I've been thinking about how television actually, and we'll talk about this, is ahead of film, but is trailing behind, as is so often the case in many areas where television and film trails behind the music industry.
Right.
We've talked about how the music industry laid out all the technical problems, be it piracy, be it digital media, all these things long before film and TV started to even consider them. But I had this experience that drove this home to me last year when I purchased the Sharon Jones Christmas album at the Strand Bookstore on Manhattan. And on the Isle of Manhattan. And then
Isle of Manhattan, the classic Strand.
I went around the corner from there to a Duane Reade to purchase a gift bag so that I could give that CD. I kept a copy for myself. Don't kid yourself. But I wanted to give it as a gift to the people that were hosting us for a dinner party, hosting me and Lily and John and Kelly Lawler, who you know.
Right.
And
yes.
While I'm looking for what little gift bag the CD will fit into, this African American woman is kind of eyeballing me, and ordinarily I wouldn't bother describing her ethnic makeup in a story, except that she demands to know. First, she goes, "That's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings on the CD."
Right.
She shoves me and says, "How do you know about Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings?" And I don't know whether it was because she recognized me from my film and podcast work and knew I was a resident of Los Angeles, or if I looked like a Manhattanite and she figured that their fame had not spread beyond the borough of Brooklyn, or if it was because, in fact, between you and me, I am white. But there was something about me, and there are many other possibilities, I know this, but there was something about me that surprised this woman that I would know of her beloved Sharon Jones, Brooklyn's own Sharon Jones. And indeed, how I came to know about Sharon Jones was through my love of another artist. Through my love, in this instance, of the great Paul Weller from the Jam and the Style Council and his long and august solo career. I learned when he was coming to L.A. at one point that the opening act at the Greek Theater was going to be a woman named Sharon Jones and her band, the Dap Kings. So I immediately wanted to avail myself of their offerings. And so that if it was as good as I would expect, I would make sure to get to the Greek plenty early so I could hear everything of the opening act, which not everybody does in LA. So I immediately fell in love with Sharon Jones and with her music. And it underscored something I've talked about many times in the past. But people who love music know this, that when you fall in love with an artist and with their work, you then find yourself wanting to learn about who their influences were.
Yes.
And if
that's a classic thing to do.
Yeah. And if you like then the music by their influences, well, then you start to learn about who their influences were. And in the process of just following, learning about an artist you really enjoy, you can develop a very diverse array of music for your enjoyment, diverse in terms of era, diverse in terms of gender, diverse in terms of genre, because musical artists are influenced by other genres. Diverse in terms of even, well, obviously ethnicity, but even nationalities. Just following one artist, if you really want to avail yourself of everyone that influenced them, I guarantee you it's a globe-trotting and time-traveling adventure exploring those inspirations. And so it seems to me we all know instinctively how to embrace cultural expression and artistic expression with real diversity through how we pursue our musical tastes.
Right. So did you explain this in the Duane Reid, much like in this
paragraph? Ryan Lescote had not written that letter yet to us.
Oh, I see. So therefore,
I explained
the woman
to the woman that I was actually an illegitimate offspring of several of the Dap Kings. I don't know. I don't remember what I said. I just probably said she's great. She's great. And I probably just compared notes with her on some of the songs that we love and some of the live performances we'd seen. And then, of course, I had my bodyguard slap her around a little bit.
No, you did not. That's not how that story ended.
But, you know, the problem, of course, why this method doesn't translate to television is that most people who create television, their other influences are other American television. Until recently, it was pretty rare when the story behind the creation of a show would be, I saw a show from another country. And, that's a pretty rare phenomenon. So, so the influence behind the creation of television for the first, 40 years at least of television, and there are some outliers of shows that were based on British shows, but still, let's face it, we're still basically saying that those are, for the most part, shows by white men being inspired by shows by white men.
Right.
For a long time.
Right.
And yeah. And so we'll talk about that. But I did think, you know, we don't talk about music often, although we're doing much more lately because of our top 10 musicals. And
that's
you,
right.
And you being addicted to internet radio station that plays nothing but Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames.
That's right. I listen to that over and over. It's called British 60s Radio. That's right. It's throwbacks to 1960s. Obscure British hits.
I might have to create a sting for the show that is the Chilpack Hollywood Correction of the Week. but don't worry, Dean Haglund, the correction is mine.
Well,
I was speaking about La La Land last week, was correct in saying that the director Damien Chazelle's favorite film and his inspiration was... Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but I was in fact in other aspects of Damien Chazelle getting him confused with Derek Cianfrance, who was actually the director of Blue Valentine. The director of La La Land did not do Blue Valentine with Ryan Gosling, not at all. So a mea culpa from me when I was talking off the top of my head. Damien Chazelle, of course, directed the excellent, in fact, I would say the vastly superior to La La Land, Whiplash. That was his prior and Oscar-winning film.
Oscar-winning. No less.
So my apologies.
So there you go. That's your mea culpa.
My apologies. Everyone go back to your places of worship. put away the pitchforks. Boy, 2016's been rough, Dean Haglund. A lot of great celebrities dying. And why would there be a break from it this week? I don't. Of course.
I don't know why.
Celebrity death.
Is it because there's a lot of great celebrities and it's just
there's fewer and fewer every day, sir? I remember we were talking about how we're losing one vintage neon sign a week in Los Angeles. Vintage neon might have been just a metaphor for celebrated actor or performer. So we do love to celebrate character actors, especially.
Yes, we do.
On this mm-hmm. show. The known unknown players that really make us believe the worlds we're watching. And another one of these great performers died this week. Alice Drummond.
You're from where?
If you look up the definition of prolific character actress,
mm-hmm.
you would get a definition of a prolific character actress, which is what Alice Drummond was. She was actually nominated for Best Featured Actress Tony in 1970, but probably best known for supporting appearances, character roles in such films as Awakenings, Synecdoche,
right.
New York, and Ghostbusters. Among many others. She died November 30th from complications following a fall in her home. She was 88 years of age. So born in 1928 in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. A lot of great character actors, by the way. Born and raised in Rhode Island. Which I guess makes sense because there's always been a thriving regional and repertory theater scene there.
Yeah.
She was a 1950 graduate of Pembroke College, which was at that point the women's school at Brown University, and began her acting career following a move to New York with fellow actor Paul Drummond, whom she married in 1951. They divorced 25 years later. And she was a regular on and off Broadway over the next four decades.
Wow.
You hone your craft. Would you not doing on and off Broadway for 40 years?
Yes, 40 years. That's that is four decades. That means you must be so young when you started and you grew up on stage. Think of that. All the changes that an artist goes through for four decades of performing. That's quite an accomplishment.
And the diverse array of performers that you're learning from while working with them.
That's true. You must have started back in the 50s, I assume.
Yeah, came in 51, yeah. So,
so
you're seeing the advent of the method on stage.
That's right. So you would have been working with the likes of Paul Newman and who else was the great?
Well, I guess Brando, we don't talk about Brando anymore in the wake of the Bernardo Bertolucci admission for Last Hangar in Paris. So he's dead to me. Anyway, she was nominated for a Tony for her performance in Murray Shizgle's The Chinese. Earlier, she appeared in an off-Broadway revival of Edward Albee's The American Dream. And in 1980, at the American Place Theater, in the ensemble of Levon Mueller's Killings on the Last Line. One of her most notable performances was as Aunt Ruth in 1991 in the New York premiere of Scott McPherson's Marvin's Room, which, of course, was made into an award-winning movie as well. She played many memorable and sometimes iconic character roles on film and television. Among them, in the 1960s, she appeared in a recurring role on the supernatural soap opera Dark Shadows.
Of course.
In the role of Nurse Jackson. She was perhaps most famously a New York City librarian in the opening sequences of the original Ghostbusters. She was one of the patients that Robin Williams' doctor character is treating in the 1990 film Awakenings. She was a regular on the CBS soap Where the Heart Is, appearing on the show until it ended its run, and later appeared briefly on As the World Turns. Her numerous television guest spots include Spin City, Boston Legal, Ed, Law and Order, The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, and Grace Under Fire. Alice Drummond, a great character actress, 88 years of age.
Look at that.
Now, speaking of television, and we're going to be doing a lot of that over the next few minutes, we have kind of kept track a little bit in this, the 50th anniversary of year of Star Trek, of the original Star Trek.
Yes.
We've kept track of what's been going on with the franchise, and it's been a bit of a rough year as far as anniversaries.
Yes,
go.
Let's say roller coaster.
And the roller coaster continued with what I would say was very exciting news for the forthcoming spin-off series Star Trek Discovery, where the first members of the cast were announced this week.
Oh,
you did not see this.
I did not see this.
Okay, well, first, the show, what we know is that the show is set 10 years before the events of the original Star Trek series.
Wow.
It's separate from the timeline of these concurrent feature films that are being made. The J.J. Abrams universe, if we call it that. So it's in the universe of the original series, and it will bridge stories between Star Trek Enterprise and the original Star Trek series. And Discovery explores a previously mentioned event from that history's timeline. Announced this week, playing a captain, a recurring captain, because this is going to be the one of the first. I mean, Deep Space Nine started this way. We're getting into the weeds here. But then it started by focusing on someone other than a captain. It was Commander Benjamin Sisko, but then he does end up becoming a captain. So this show, again, like that, focuses as its main character not on a ship captain, but as a ship first officer, number one, is what she's referred to, which is a tribute going all the way back to The Cage, where Majel Barrett played the first officer, known only as Number One. And apparently by the end of this first season, we might learn the character's name. But Number One, a female first officer, is the main character. No casting, as far as I'm sure, as far as I know, has been announced yet. But a recurring captain character has been announced, and that recurring starship captain character will be played by the great Michelle Yeoh.
Wow.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon fame, of course, one of my all-time favorite. I was such a devotee of Hong Kong cinema in the late 80s and into the mid-90s, and there was no better star coming out of there, man or woman, than Michelle Yeoh. This is a terrific, exciting news to me. Also exciting,
absolutely,
playing one of the series regulars, a crewman who is an alien, a crew member that's an alien.
Right.
Our friend, is there anyone nicer than this guy? Doug Jones.
No way. Yeah, fantastic. So this sounds like it's going to be tons of action and great CGI, because Doug, you know, it's been so many characters that you haven't recognized because he's been CGI'd beyond the recognition from seeing him at the cons. So this sounds thrilling, actually.
So, yes, very exciting news. Also exciting is the fact that apparently not only will you be able to, Dean, down there, down under, be able to watch this show when it drops, because it turns out it's not just a CBS All Access show. It's CBS All Access in the U.S. and Canada. And even though it says All Access, do we all have access to it? I don't know. I've never gone to that site.
I don't think so.
188 other countries, it drops day and date on Netflix.
Oh, hooray. My lifeline. Other than...
So that's exciting.
Home and Away.
That's very exciting.
That's
very exciting news, and really something to celebrate for the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, that this could be a global event. And and if in the keeping of the original series and Gene Roddenberry's vision, you know, if this is depicting, again, as I probably declare too often on this show, but if it's but if it's depicting a future worth striving for, then I'm all for this being a global event.
That's so true, because at any time in our history did we need to think of a future worth striving for.
Now, we don't like to deal strictly in the positive.
No, of course not.
So
when do we ever?
We giveth reason for optimism, and here we taketh away. You remember when I was really, really pessimistic about this. Of course, it was shoved down my throat that the reason that I should be optimistic is that Brian Fuller was, in addition to creating the show, going to be the showrunner. And we've talked at length before on this show, and might again on a future installment where we talk about our top television shows of 2016, discuss the importance of showrunners. As we know, and we talked about a few weeks ago, Brian Fuller was relieved of command. They delayed the launch of the show once from January to May to fit his schedule better because he's busy on so many other projects. But what came out this week is news that a lot of these fans that I heard from clearly could not have been hoping for. Following his exit in October as showrunner, Brian Fuller has now confirmed he has no ongoing role whatsoever in Star Trek Discovery.
So he just gets the...
I'm not involved in production or post-production. I can only give them the material I've given them, which is the first two episodes, and hope that it is helpful for them. So he's not even an executive producer. I mean, I'm sure as the creator, he gets an executive producer title, but he's not in on any meetings. He's not being CC'd on memos. He gets no input on decisions. He went on to say when telling Newsweek about this, quote, "I'm curious to see what they do with this show." Aren't we all?
Yeah, I think that's how he approaches all his projects, isn't it? I'm curious what I'm going to do with this project.
Yeah, but he's curious what they are, not what he is. He'll find out.
I know.
When we all find out, pretty much, apparently.
Well, that's good. Mm-hmm.
Well, no, it's probably not good when the creator of the show is cut out of the loop. It means methinks there is a story here.
I imagine that there's, like any time, creative differences and or that the scope of the project requires so much concentration that you're not going to pick somebody who's got 1,000 other projects on the run.
Well, you know, whenever I hear about anybody getting into creative differences with the powers that be at Paramount, I understand it immediately because the difference is that the storytellers are creative and Paramount is not. So there's the creative difference for you. Hi, Dean and Phil. This topic may have been discussed on a previous episode of My Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. In fact, I think it was discussed briefly last week. However, it was brought up on a different podcast, and I was curious to hear your take on it. I was listening to an episode of the Slash Film podcast, and one of their listeners posed a question on the subject of diversity in television. The question was, interesting that this would be posed on a show called Slash Film, which I would think would be about movies. And as was said to me and pointed out in real startling detail, you know, although there's a lot of hope that the awards this year are going to reflect greater diversity in Hollywood, really, overall, we might be at a point in terms of diversity in movies where we are further behind. We've regressed over the last 25 years, if anything.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. What I was reading and what I was hearing and looking at, it's just kind of stunning. But television, different. This, if we can call it the golden age of television in which we're living, in terms of creative content, there's just so much good stuff out there, and there really is a great deal of diversity. It seems to be different. Anyway, the question was, what is the best approach to ensure there is diversity on television? Is it through having shows that focus on a specific culture, ethnicity, or struggle, such as ABC's Blackish, Fresh Off the Boat, and Speechless, which respectively focus on African Americans, Asian Americans, and families with special needs children? Boy, that's the one we may have stopped on last week, but boy, the disabled. When we talk about diversity, it seems like the disabled rarely even get included in that conversation.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, that's true.
And actors with disabilities, the haystack that they are the needle in is itself a needle in the haystack, right? I mean,
exactly. Off the top of my head, I could think of Breaking Bad, and I think there's a new series coming out.
Well, they talked about this one, Speechless with special needs.
Yes, that's the new one.
Or is a better approach the approach taken by shows such as NBC's Park and Recreation and Superstore, as well as Fox's Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which have non-white actors playing major roles? I am of the mindset that both approaches work and serve a purpose, and that as long as the audience is given a compelling and engaging story, we are all the better for it. However, that is just my opinion, and I'm sure the other loyal listeners would love to hear what you have to say. Thanks for the enlightening discussions and the great podcasts, Ryan Lascotti. Dean, your thoughts?
Well, yes. I mean, often you see in casting breakdowns that there's very specific ethnic lines that seem to be a decision not from story, but from a mathematical algorithm, as it were, in terms of how these sitcoms and TV shows are cast. That said, as you point out, the regression that's going on means that these formulas are imperfect and/or forgotten about. So is it cyclical, and what is the best method? We just did a movie that had major ethnic diversity, but we didn't go out of our way. We just cast a lot of our friends.
Well,
right?
No, I mean, it was a diversity was in mind from the beginning of that, but also it's a film. So I mean, the question is about television. I want to kind of stay away from film at the You know, right now is a very interesting time in the wake of, although this is a film controversy, but in the wake of Oscars So White, an interesting thing happened in the television industry this year where agents and managers were pretty much told, don't bother submitting your Caucasian actors or actresses for these character roles, be they guest stars or recurring or, you know, on shows. Because, you know, they figured these are a good opportunity to get diversity in.
Right.
So there's been a real effort to bend over backwards almost to make sure that regardless of whether or not the part was written for, quote unquote, a person of color, that people of color are seen for them. And that's a major step because I always said that, you know, the The source of the anger is misplaced when there is a whitewashed role, going all the way back to the Miss Saigon controversy, right, where Jonathan Pryce was cast as the Eurasian engineer in that musical, and there was a lot of picketing about that from the Asian American community, and I said, I took the standpoint of kind of how dare you tell a director who he or she cannot cast for a role. The director needs to be able to pick who they think is best for that role. And the problem is not that Jonathan Pryce or any other white actor took a role, quote unquote, from an Asian or Asian American performer. It's that the door never seems to swing the other way. Right?
Right.
And I personally have had experiences when pitching projects where when I said actors that I wanted to have play it, the look was, but they're... that actor is Asian. And I would say, you are correct, you know? and then they would say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Which, and my response would be, well, won't he be pleased to hear that? There's nothing wrong with you being Asian. You were just born that way. And, but their confusion always lied in, but the part's not Asian, the part's white. The character's white.
Right.
And I wrote this, and I would say, well, why do you say that? And they would say, because it doesn't say that he's Asian. So the default, is this racism? Well, if it is, it's of a kind that does not come from a damaged, wounded heart or hatred. It's the kind of racism that is ingrained and almost institutional and very much one we need to be on the lookout for, but not one that we have to make a personal attack against people. You have to try to change the way people look at this and point out and say, look, that's a prejudice that you assume, unless otherwise mentioned, that that this character is white.
I think back to even commercials in the 70s and 80s, right, where you started seeing more and more people of color in commercials, and that it stood out as like, oh, look at that diversity. But as it carried on, it became more and more a matter of fact, right?
There are so many television shows, as Dana Carvey said to me and Lily one night, there are so many television shows now, it is as if there are no television shows now. And it is a terrible time, he said, to become rich and famous, but it is a fantastic time to be creative. There's no excuse to not make something creative. And so there's plenty of opportunities to hopefully tell stories that focus on the lives and existences of a diverse range of groups of people within this culture. That can be people of different colors, different religions, different genders, hopefully people with disabilities as well. And also, as we've talked about before, different ages, because ageism exists. So you want to focus your stories on the full, beautiful mosaic that actually makes up life in the United States and life around the planet. But certainly, since we're talking about the television industry here for the most part, I would imagine, the beautiful mosaic of America should be reflected on the stories we tell. Also, yes, how about colorblind casting? How about casting someone of a different background for a role, especially when their specific background isn't authored by the creator of the show?
Right.
If it isn't a plot point, if it isn't,
pointed out.
Yeah, because they'll bring something new and something unexpected. They will bring their life experiences to it as an actor, and it will open up possibilities you never would have had as a storyteller otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So you need both these things. But I think to focus alone on casting is a mistake. How about the storytellers themselves? That's when you start to really make a dent and create something called infinite diversity and infinite combinations, as Gene Roddenberry would have said. We need showrunners who are people of color. We need women directing shows. We need older people. You've told me about this. We need older people writing comedy scripts. Right?
Yeah.
Because weren't you telling me about the ageism when it comes to teleplay writing in sitcoms?
Yeah, for sure. And that anybody over 30 either has an outdated sense of humor or can't do the distance in the comedy room when it comes to staying up to 4 a.m. pounding out.
Doesn't have the stamina, yeah. as our president-elect would say. doesn't have the look. Doesn't have the look.
Yeah.
So you need that. And also, how about the executive suite? That needs to be diverse. That can't be a white boys club either.
Right.
You know, hats off.
All those eggheads from Harvard running everything.
Hats off to my dear friend Channing Dungey, who I went to film school with, a collaborator of mine many, many years ago. She's the president of ABC now, the first African-American, and maybe, could it be that she's the first woman to run a major network? That's possible, but she's certainly the first person. She's certainly the first person of color to run one of the big three, one of the big four networks. And the truth is that her work up until then already showed that she was opening doors for a wide array of people. You think of some of the shows, because before she became the president of ABC, she was before that, among other things, the head of dramatic programming. You think of shows like Quantico. You think of the Shonda Rhimes shows. The beautiful mosaic of America is represented. Whether I enjoy the kind of shows that they have is another thing altogether. I enjoy the casting they bring to these shows. As someone was saying at a screening of the Denzel Washington Fences I attended today from the August Wilson play, you know, they couldn't wait to see Viola Davis in the film. And the next thing out of their mouth was how they can't stop watching How to Get Away with Murder, even though How to Get Away with Murder is literally getting away with murder because it's so bad, but they can't stop watching because they get to watch Viola Davis act each week. And
well,
she's
yes.
that good.
I know. And that's often, you know, TV series where the performance transcends the writing is rare, but it happens. And it does make for, you know, great television. I don't know, but it's certainly entertaining television.
But I you know, have become the Malcolm Gladwell, who we've spoken of this year on and off on this show. He had a very interesting take about the NFL, the National Football League, and how their players should exercise, flex a little more power in terms of negotiations with the league. And it was to stop negotiating with the league and start negotiating with the league's sponsors. Hit the league where it hurts by having all your biggest stars sign letters that go to the sponsors and say, you know, this is the treatment that we get as players. This is how little our health and safety concerns the people who are making money off of our bodies, off of our brain injuries, etc. And you know, if Tom Brady and all the other great quarterbacks in the league held a press conference saying, don't buy American cars until the NFL agrees to more rigorous brain testing or whatever the issue is, how fast do you think things would change? The companies would
Absolutely.
Put pressure on the league. There is something to this, I think, about in television at least, especially at a time when there's more and more product integration paying for these shows. What if the artists and the performers, especially when it comes to social issues like diversity or for opportunities for the disabled or opportunities for the elderly or what have you, if you gather together and use your fame, use your celebrity to put pressure on the advertisers to hit the corporate executives that run the television business where they live in the pocketbook?
Well, see, now this comes to the point next that I thought would be adjunct to this conversation is about marketing itself, about statistics, about surveys, consumer surveys, where it's like, oh, what do you think when you see this picture of two people using this product? You know, that sort of thing. And a lot of these surveys have systemic not racism, but systemic cultural issues already in place as they pose the question. So I wonder if the marketing aspect of how they gather their analytics and statistics then flow backwards into the creative realm, where they get the marching orders saying, no, you have to have X many persons of color and X many others for the very purpose that we learned in our consumer surveys.
Well, that's actually kind of hopeful in an interesting way, right? And it falls under a heading that we talk about sometimes on this show, where positive change has been made because people have realized, corporations have realized, that it's in their financial best interest to do the right thing.
Right.
It makes sense to do the right thing, whether it be Walmart, sponsoring and investing in the organic food movement because they need better publicity. And then lo and behold, they find out that they're making money off selling that stuff because people really hunger for it.
Right, exactly. So they become the largest buyer of organic food in the world now, right? So, yeah, so there is hope, but at the same time, I wonder,
But it has to be all these
with
things.
This election.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we also live inside our own internet bubbles, where we're just reflecting back our own idiosyncrasies.
I would say if we learn something from this election, it's that a huge population base in this country did not feel connected to in any way. And I understand the response from other, minority groups who say, wow, we really feel bad for the downtrodden whites in this country who feel unseen and unheard. Welcome to the plight of being a woman, being elderly, being a Native American, being a person of color, being disabled in America throughout its history. Now you know how we have always felt, right? And that's fine, but we want to lift everyone. We don't want to reduce everyone down to the same level. That's not equality. We want to lift everyone. And it is through people feeling seen and heard. We know this from our own experiences, making Truth Is Out There. It is remarkably healing when people realize that you're listening to them, that you're seeing them, that you're interested in their stories. And so what an important social responsibility television, and when we say television, again, we mean episodic storytelling. That's what we mean.
Right.
Be it on the internet, be it something like Other Space on Yahoo, which you championed last year. What a diverse cast that was. Or whether it be something like a Shonda Rhimes show on ABC. Whatever it is, we're calling it television, but we mean episodic storytelling. And it's a social responsibility in this medium to make sure that this mosaic that makes up the country recognizes themselves in this medium. And they're not just going to want to watch shows that are about themselves, obviously, but as long as there are shows that reflect who they are, they're going to feel included in the medium and will probably then pay attention to other shows as well.
Absolutely. Like, I'm thinking now, when I grew up, the character I most identified with on television was Jimmy Walker, JJ, on Good Times. Here was a struggling artist painting in a one-bedroom apartment in a small place, trying to gain success. That is the character I can relate to. His color, his race, his Chicago projects, none of that relayed to me because the storytelling was great about an artist living in poverty.
Really, the reason that you related to him so much was that you knew that one day in the late 1980s, Phil Lernis would perform stand-up comedy opening for Jimmy Walker. And really would then spend the rest of his life opening for Dean Hagland. Okay.
let's
talk about some movies, because the season of self-congratulation is among us in Hollywood.
Yay.
We're in it. National Board.
I congratulate you for that season of congratulations.
No, you want to congratulate yourself. actor, congratulate thyself. National Board of Review announced their awards. The New York Film Critics, Sight and Sound. And it seems to be that the American films, we're starting to see a little bit of a consensus build. At this point, now, some of the big films haven't come out yet, and there were a couple of films that the New York Film Critics Circle didn't get to see, though I don't think any of them would, other than the Martin Scorsese film, would have made a dent. But the three at this point that seem to be the big guns, the ones to beat for the major awards, the best pictures, the best casts, the best directors, are Manchester by the Sea from playwright Kenneth Lonergan, Moonlight, and the aforementioned La La Land. I got my answer, I guess. La La Land is being well received, at least outside LA, by critics. Now, again, I don't know if that's the same thing as general audiences loving this story about the touching plight of actors. But
right.
but I wanted to talk about this Moonlight. I have yet to see it. I missed a screening of it. But, you know, a couple years ago in this show, I was talking about how there was a company, a distribution company, that I was keeping my eye on, A24, because I noticed that every goddamn movie they released was worth seeing. They weren't all necessarily what you would call good, but they were really interesting. Like, as soon as I saw the A24 logo on a poster at the front of a trailer, I just would say, okay, mm-hmm. I've seen enough. I'm going to see it. I'm going to see the movie. Movies like Ex Machina, movies like Room, which won Oscars. It Follows, one of my favorite films, right? And this year, Moonlight, which is a front runner for all the top awards, and this is the first film that they actually financed completely in addition to distributing. It's the kind of movie that no other studio would. Writer-director Barry Jenkins has been trying to make it for 8 years. And anyway, I'm thrilled to get to hopefully get to see this soon. I've heard nothing but great things. It's Moonlight, and this actor that I've been talking about, it seems every other week, Mahershala Ali from Luke Cage and House of Cards and the 4400, he's been winning a lot of supporting actor awards for this.
Ooh.
So those are the big
That's exciting.
Three when it comes to the top prizes.
Right.
We're saying.
It sounds exciting. And for me, La La Land sounds like everything that I want in a movie.
Okay.
I just sounds like it.
See, Magical whereas realism. Moonlight is everything I want because it's all about diversity. As opposed to the romantic trouble of two 30-something white people. But,
Zinger, I didn't realize that was the plot line.
So, musical and modern I don't LA. Know, again, I mean, white people championing the importance of jazz music also is just another... you know how I feel about the noble white guy movies. I'm just... Anyway,
okay.
But darn, they're cute, the Gosling and the Stone, and they're singing and they're dancing and they're loving, they're forlorn loving. But this Manchester by the Sea, by God, is this a good piece? By God, does this not go by any numbers? By God, is it proof that we need more playwrights making movies? Because Kenneth Lonergan found his voice as an acclaimed playwright. This is his third feature film. And so important to its success that Matt Damon, who did produce it, had to drop out as the lead and replaced himself with Casey Affleck because this heartbreaking depiction of this man and what he has endured in his life and what he must now confront in the wake of his brother's death... would have been softened by having the most recognizable movie star on the planet play the part. Because we might have felt for his plight, but we would have deep down been saying, oh, I feel bad for him, but you know, he'll get to do another Jason Bourne movie.
Yeah.
Whereas with Casey Affleck, we're seeing a real guy. You know, the suspension of the disbelief is so immediate. And so we're immersing ourselves in the very real world of this character. And it's a world that we haven't seen on screen. And again, like we were talking about with television, it's one of these worlds and one of these stories that will speak to people and say, hey, Yes, someone is telling stories that express how hard it is sometimes to get through life.
Wow, exactly. And who doesn't want to hear that story?
The young man whose name escapes me, but who plays Casey Affleck's nephew in it, has been winning a lot of breakout star awards for this role. And it's a really, really amazing performance by this young man.
Okay.
And you know that Casey Affleck's performance is Oscar worthy when you start seeing headlines again about the times he settled sexual assault and harassment suits from several years ago. Those headlines are coming out again, and a lot of people are hearing about it for the first time. But back when Casey Affleck made that that Joaquin Phoenix mockumentary, I'm Still Here, he was sued by a couple of women, and a nasty, nasty business. But the point that I'm making is the award season is a political campaign, and the dirt comes out because rival studios use it to try to decrease the chances of films at other studios from winning awards.
Isn't that nuts?
I guess. I don't know. You know, it's interesting. Here's the question that I'll bring up about it, and I didn't mean to get into this, really, the topic, but somebody said, and it's a point, it's a valid point, right? Well, shouldn't the awards just be about the quality of the work? And
right. Well, I would think.
One would think. However, the problem is, now he settled. He settled both these cases.
Right.
Whether I believe he was guilty of this inappropriate, shockingly inappropriate behavior that traumatized a female cinematographer who was the only woman on the set, whether I believe that he was, and he was, guilty of this, makes no bearing on this. But if he gives an award-worthy performance, let's give him the award, except clearly there's no ramification in terms of ever getting jobs, which is where maybe it should come into play. Right. But this dirt is never coming out. All these people who do this terrible stuff, as long as they make money for the right people, they keep getting more opportunities, no matter who they are. And I'm not saying we don't forgive people, and I'm not saying we don't give other chances, but I am saying it seems like the only time there's ever any penance to be paid, it's through the denial of awards.
Oh, you think that's where it hits them, where it hurts?
Well, no, but I'm saying that's the only time it ever comes up, because it doesn't come up clearly when the conversation is about hiring them. You know,
right.
No one is apparently saying, hey, you know what? I'm uncomfortable hiring an actor who has sexually assaulted people. I think there's plenty of actors who need opportunities that don't do that.
Right.
I'm just saying that if that conversation, shouldn't that be a hiring conversation versus, you know, before we let someone back into the workplace where women are, where we want women to feel safe, before we let that happen, let's have the conversation about what he did or didn't do. Let's talk to him about this. But no, these conversations only ever come up around the awards. And that's what really strikes me as vulgar.
Yes, I could see that. But there's, when you say settled, did he apologize? Has he learned?
I don't want,
did he realize the error was?
Again, I didn't want to get
into
the weeds on him. But, maybe this is the time that we have to talk about it, is about the awards, because it's the only time it'll ever get a hearing. It'll ever.
Wow, that's right.
You know, maybe
that's a good point.
Maybe that is why. So,
okay, I give you that one.
I saw, I guess I should talk about a couple of the new films. I did see Fences from, speaking of playwrights, the great playwright August Wilson wrote the screenplay based on his tremendous play Fences. It's, I think, the directorial debut for Denzel Washington. I'm not sure if he's directed something else, but what I love is that Denzel Washington uses his power as an actor to get a film made that is that play is a great work of art, and it was never going to get made otherwise. So good for Denzel Washington using his cachet and his power to get this thing made. The performance by lead actor Denzel Washington is spectacular. The direction in those scenes that focus on Denzel Washington suffers, as one might expect. And it's the times when this film feels most like a play, which again makes sense, because the actor who was immersed in the subjectivity of the story in those moments had a hard time depicting those scenes in the objective way they might need cinematically. But when the focus is on some of the other exceptional members of the ensemble, like Michael T. Williamson as his mentally disabled through injury, through war injury, brother, or when it focuses on Viola Davis's character, the main character's long-suffering wife, it's not only riveting and moving and powerful, but it also feels like a movie.
Right.
It's visual poetry in those scenes.
Wow.
So an important movie, a lovely movie, and darn if Viola Davis probably, I think she's got a real good chance at winning the Oscar.
I love it. Now, did you see this on stage ever?
I think I did see it on stage, but I realized that I think I must have seen it on stage, and I'll tell you why. I have the play. I read the play in college. I own a copy of the play. But interestingly enough, there was a moment in the movie where the main character, Denzel Washington's lifelong best friend, pulls him aside, takes him down an alley to have a conversation with him. And the shot where he's leading him away, I suddenly knew what they were going to talk about. Which makes me think that something about that visual reminded me of the experience of seeing the play. Because I
right.
suddenly knew. And why that occurred was, up until then, I was going, you know, we love Viola Davis, but why does it need to be her in this movie? This role is, it's fine, but it's not worthy of Viola Davis. Why her? And it's almost
right.
distracting having a performer of her caliber do such empty lifting in this film. But once the best friend leads Denzel Washington's character down the alley, I suddenly went, oh, right. Okay, it's about to become the Viola Davis show.
Right.
And it does, and it's great, and her performance is terrific, just fantastic. And and again, as a director, one of the things that I love that Denzel lets his actors do is really embody the experiences of their characters, convey their experiences and their emotions and their energy physically. Which they would do in the theater, and which the cinema allows us to really feel viscerally. It's just director Denzel Washington doesn't give actor Denzel Washington the same permission very often, where much more of it is close-up, which is kind of the default of how do I shoot a play. Oh, well, you know, plays can't use close-ups. We'll use close-ups. Right.
Yeah. Right.
So, but I think it does have something to do with the intense subjectivity of the role, taking him out of the objectivity of the directing. Two other movies that I saw that I want to discuss with you, Dean Haglund, real quick, because they're actually two movies you've seen.
Oh, great! How rare is that?
I saw The Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
With a 4D sense around. Shake your chair and spit water in your face?
Halfway. I went halfway to 4D. I went with a 2D experience. And I really enjoyed this movie. I thought it did a very nice job of world building, of introducing us to this world, of showing us, a period depiction of America and how the magic community might was developing with alongside, underneath the magic community. I love how there's so much fear in the American magic community that they are going to be exposed because it will lead to warfare. And you're sitting there going, yeah, it probably would, but not because you have magic so much as it's the 1920s and your president is a woman when women can't even vote in mainstream America, and she's a black woman.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I didn't even, speaking of diversity, I didn't even notice that.
There is so much fun stuff about it being set in America that is clearly of import to J.K. Rowling in this. The whole theme is about how it's about the Jungian shadow archetype. It is about how that which as children remains unexpressed will fester and become the shadow archetype, will become disowned, and will seek expression at the worst possible time and lead to destruction. Welcome to the U.S. election 2016. It's fascinating stuff. But just from as an adjunct to the Harry Potter universe, you know, there were some reviews that said, okay, well, it's good movie making, but it lacks the magic. It's slow, and it lacks the magic of the Harry Potter movies. Two things: those Harry Potter movies were sometimes too fast paced, and the reason that they were so fast paced was that they were cutting those books down to their barest plot essentials.
Right, and not bothering to build the world or any of that.
This is the first movie...
As Harry discovered it.
This is the first movie that feels like a J.K. Rowling book, where this exciting thing will happen, and then there's these passages of walking through the world. And,
right.
And the other thing is, for these critics who say that it doesn't have that sense of magic, I think they are comparing it to the high points of the Harry Potter cinematic franchise and to the later movies, and not again to the early movies that are unwatchable.
Right.
Those early movies are bad, and this first movie is head and shoulders above them. Now, as with any, you know, installment that creates a new universe, the proof will be in the ensuing chapters. But I really, I was really delighted by it. And when a movie is called Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, I am so glad that, unlike all the Harry Potter movies, we actually got Fantastic Beasts. We got to know them. We got to enjoy them. They weren't just little either comic relief or plot points. They
They were
wonderful
characters.
Getting to see the ecology that exists in the magic realm, but that is endangered by magical human beings who don't take care of these creatures.
It's an environmental message.
Yeah.
That I managed to appreciate as chemical smells were being sprayed at me while my seat shook around. I got to actually remember that the environmental message of the natural world, even in a magical realm, is very important.
One final movie, and then we're over time. We got to go. But I saw one of your top 10 all-time favorite Westerns. I watched Delmer Daves' 1958 Western Cowboy, starring Glenn Ford and Jack Lemmon. It was Delmer Daves and Glenn Ford's reteaming 2 years after they did one of my all-time favorites, 3:10 to Yuma. And this is a really interesting film. I actually thought, because you liked it, because it's Jack Lemmon, and because of how it begins, that this was going to be kind of a sly comedic take on it. It could not be anything further from that.
I know. It takes such a tonal shift once you're on the trail.
This
is a bit of a surprise.
Is about the very real men upon whom the mythos of the Old West was built. And it really shows the differences between the real thing and the mythos.
Yes. And it's fascinating, right? Because that's where not only is Jack Lemmon disillusioned by that, but he also steps up to it at the same time.
Yeah,
that's what
he
I think it's really great.
He becomes.
Yeah, he becomes.
He's so disillusioned by what he finds, but nevertheless, he becomes the greatest embodiment of that which has disillusioned him.
Which is so rare in writing and even to pitch as an idea. Is pretty fantastic.
Anyway, that brings us to an end of another exciting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
write a review, why don't you?
What could be more fun? And, of course, like us on Facebook.
Please like us. Facebook. We're at Facebook.com at Chillpack Hollywood.
No,
Chillpack Hollywood.
Facebook.com/ yeah. Chillpack Hollywood. Write us. We want to talk about what you want us to talk about. It's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. Write us ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com. How can they follow us on Twitter and Instagram, Dean?
Well, it's the same on both. It's Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and we give great hashtag.
Yes, another Instagram photo will drop roughly around the same time as this very show. Once a week on Monday, we post a new photo. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.